Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
What a nice big group today. Great to see you all. I gotta drink tea. Got a cold and it helps. So last time I gave a talk, well, first I just wanted to say that when we give talks here, it's usually about something we're contemplating, you know, for ourselves in our own life. At least, well, I should just speak for myself. That's what it's about when I give a talk. It's about something that I'm working with, something that I'm digesting, contemplating. So, and we hope when we give our talks, I think I can speak for everyone with this, that it's you find something helpful in that. So last time I talked about, and it's also about what people are bringing to us in one-to-one, you know, talks, what the things that are coming up for the people that we meet with. So last time I talked about taking refuge and about offering the refuge of non-fear to others, offering non-fear. And against the backdrop of the divisiveness in our culture, in our country, that was, and some of the incidents of aggression towards vulnerable people. So that was the context of this giving non-fear. And we ended it with a song called Sanctuary. I don't know, some of you were there and you sang along, and we don't have any songs today, I'm sorry. No songs unless you want to sing them, unless you want to share them at the end. So I've been thinking about this metaphor of sanctuary. That's what I've been turning over in my mind, Yeah, in terms of sanctuary, in terms of place, and sanctuary in terms of... Sanctuary is a metaphor for place, for the self. For mainly the sense of place and the sense of self. As a place where practice enlightenment is cultivated, bhavana, cultivation, which in Zen is... really, most of the time, no cultivation, just sitting, continuous practice. So studying sanctuary as the self, studying the self in relationship, in action, in stillness, through the body, through letting go, and through digesting our experience. Someday I'm going to give a talk without any notes. It's an aspiration. Every time I say I'm going to do it, I'm going to do that, and I say I'm going to just make a brief outline, and then I just write, and then it comes out like 14 pages. But it's really big print, so if I used a regular font, it would only be 7 or less, so just so you know. We need big print as we're getting older here. So sanctuary's been on my mind, sanctuary as place, because of the work that's being done that I'm very privy to at Hokyoji Zen Practice Community, plans for building a new building, capital campaign, the process of it, how many hours go into that of minute types of work, you know, lots of calculations, lots of meetings, lots of planning, lots of meeting with people, communicating with people, and that's the practice. That's the practice of creating sanctuary. And Zen practice is not just the practice of stillness, of meditation, right? It's work, it's relationships, it's meetings, it's all those things. It's the simplicity of the intention and attention and the aesthetics. And so I talked about this place last time as a sanctuary and as a place where we take refuge. So it's a place of solace, but also a place where we get the courage to challenge ourselves, challenge our ways of thinking, habituated reactions, responses, and the ways that we think. So this place is Minnesota Zen Center, but it's also, it has a temple name, Gansho-ji, Living in Bao Temple. That was given it by Katagiri Roshi. Ji is just temple. So Rumon-ji, Hokyo-ji, Gansho-ji. And it's also the name of a book, which Tim has recommended to our folks, Sewing Roxu's, as a by Shohaku Okumura, a wonderful book about our practice, Soto Zen practice, Soto Zen ceremony, Soto Zen teachings. So I want to explore these metaphors with a story and a verse from the Chan literature. I'm using this Book of Serenity, which is, you know, I think it's, I kind of look at it as our Soto compendium of, Soto Zen compendium of cases. So I'm also going to talk today about the practicing right in the gap between the lofty aspirations and the teachings, the loftiness of the teachings and our actual experience. Because that's also what I'm working with. And so this case, it contains references and commentary, references to other Chan teachers, to the lofty metaphors in the Mahayana sutras, including celestial beings and gods, and the teachings. And also, it pokes at our tendency and the tendency of the teachings to become something static, something solid, some kind of thing we turn into a belief. And it's called The World Honored One Points to the Ground. And I'll read the cases. Two people here writing, commenting, Wan San and Cheng Tan. Wan San writes the case, the commentary, and Cheng Tan has done the verse, which the poetic verse, which is, as some of you know, I really like poetry, so I appreciate the poetic verse part of this case. So it also looks it pokes a little bit at our concepts of religiosity, symbols, and, you know, it talks about the 16-foot golden Buddha and merit, offerings, concepts of the sacred. So I'll read it. As the world-honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The world-honored one smiled. The world-honored one smiled. The sanctuary is built. One blade of grass. Here it is. It's already built. So this is like the view from the awakened mind. You know, that one blade of grass. One blade of grass is the perfect offering. One blade of grass. Here's the sanctuary. It's already built. It's already there, transcending the long process, which is the relative end of things, the actual day-to-day process. And it's a form of play. They're playing together. You know, he spontaneously picks up one blade of grass, this little offering, and plants it, and they kind of play. Buddha smiles back, just like Mahakashapa when Buddha held up the flower and he smiled. There's a recognition, there's a playfulness. And this is in many cases expressing the big view, the view of big mind, of the view from enlightenment or awakening. So here's his commentary. When the world-honored one spread his hair to cover mud and offered flowers to Dipankara Buddha, the lamp, that Buddha pointed to where the hair was spread and said, "A sanctuary should be built in this place." At that time, an elder known as the foremost of the wise planted a marker in that spot and said, "The building of the sanctuary is finished." The gods scattered flowers and praised him for having wisdom while being an ordinary man. The story Cheng Tong quotes here is much the same. I say, this is Wang Tsang, I say, the world-honored one's ancestral work was given over to Dipankara. Then there was the elder, getting the beginning he took in the end. Now it is given over to Tiang Tong, who must produce a matching literary talisman. Tiang Tong must produce a verse. That's a matching literary talisman. That's not really accessible, is it, that commentary? Not really. So I think I'll say a few things about it, which may or may not be, you know, the official word. Just my musings on it. So this commentary, and the commentary on the verse that I'm going to read, is speaking directly to us as the reader of this case. And it pokes us at us a bit, you know. Oh, yeah, I know you think offerings are good and that we need to make really specific, really impressive offerings and build really nice temples with 16-foot Buddhas. So he pokes at that a little bit. And from what I've been reading, Dogen's understanding from his writings about what the metaphor of the 16-foot golden Buddha means is that it's actually the person who can walk in all situations without losing their awakened mind. So, Wan Song says, that's us. Don't think it's not you. Don't think it's not you. And also the body of virtues. This reference to Dipankara is, there's a story from the Shurangama Sutra about Dipankara. He's one of the seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni. And we chant those names, I think. We recite those in one of the meal chants, I believe. Yeah, the seven names of the Buddhas before Shakyamuni. And so Dipankara shows up in this story as an old crotchety bhikkhu, and he's trying to cross a stream, but it's full of mud. And Buddha, in his past life as a bodhisattva, a monk, just a regular Joe who's trying to arouse bodhicitta and free all beings, sees Dipankara, and he says, "Oh, I really want to help this guy." And he spreads his hair over the mud to allow Dipankara, or the old bhikkhu, to cross. And so as a result of this, Dipankara is really happy. He thinks, wow, this is wonderful. And he predicts that the monk will become Shakyamuni, will be a Buddha in his future life. So these sutras, a lot of these Mahayana sutras have about all these different sections to them, and this is, one of the sections is always the predictions of future Buddhahood. So that's the deal behind that story, that metaphor for bestowing the prediction. So this 16-foot body of Buddha as our body is the body of virtues created by the Eightfold Path, right view, right action, concentration, mindfulness, speech, all those things that are the path that creates, that becomes our 16-foot body of the Buddha. So I'll read the next part, the verse. The boundless spring on the 100 plants, picking up what comes to hand, he uses it knowingly. He uses it knowingly. Picks up what's at hand, which was the blade of grass, and he uses it knowingly. The 16-foot-tall golden Buddha body, a collection of virtuous qualities, casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. Able to be master in the dust, from outside creation a guest shows up. Everywhere life is sufficient in its way, no matter if one is not as clever as others. So the dusts are, you know, the worldly roads we walk on, drive on. That's the dust. It's whatever comes up in life, right? That's the dust. So he can walk in the dust without losing his Buddha nature, his awakened mind. And this also just says everywhere life is sufficient in its way, no matter what. So we are as we are, just fine. We are as we are, just fine. And that is what Zen practice, that's what Zen teachers constantly say to us. Suzuki Roshi, you're perfect just as you are. And you could use a little improvement, right? So this is sanctuary, that attitude. Not falling into the weeds of fretting, of worry. Pointing out the timelessness of the merging of past, present, and future in the present moment. In the present moment. So keeping the view of Buddha nature, the big picture in mind. Which helps so much when working on projects, when planning for a building or creating building the organization, board meetings, etc. The devil's in the details is one view of those kind of projects, and another one is that practice enlightenment is right there in those details, in that practice. So I really have been watching the people involved more than I am with this project at Hokyoji and noticing how the practice is manifesting. Working together in harmony, dealing with conflict constructively, you know, applying the practice of Zazen to the practice of building the sanctuary. So I have a story from my own life about worry, being in the weeds of worry. I was working this summer on a conference, a big conference with my friend who's here today. And it seemed like a really, really big project with a lot of pieces and hardly any volunteers, you know, just a few of us. So I was telling her, you know, I'm kind of a little bit worried about this, that it's, you know, people aren't going to step up. And that was, I was expressing that to her. And later that day, I went out into the hallway of my building, this condominium building, and I found a package there sitting outside the door in the hallway, and I picked it up. I don't usually order things online, and it was from an old friend of ours who practiced here. And it was a package full of calligraphies that he does a lot of calligraphy. He's a good artist that way, and he had been sending them out to people that said they wanted them, you know. So it came, that's what it was, and I opened it up, and there were a number of really nice pieces, but my favorite, and I thought I will give these away as gifts, you know, to people, but the one I chose to keep, I looked on the back and it said, "Don't worry." Don't worry. So there was the teaching right there. So I'm getting that framed and hanging that on my wall. The Dharma's everywhere. It comes up in surprising places. So the added sayings are really fun in this. These are sayings by Wansong. They're, he's talking to us here. So he says, as the Buddha was walking with the congregation, he comments on this, going along following the heels of another, he pointed to the ground and said, this spot is good to build a sanctuary. Shouldn't move earth on the head of the guardian spirit. See, he's just poking, you know. He's just poking. Guardian spirits, you know. Don't build where there's the guardian spirits are. Indra struck a blade of grass in the ground and said, the sanctuary is built. Wansong's comment, repairs won't be easy. These are funny, these cases, you know. The Buddha smiled. Reward and punishment are distinctly clear. Now he's bringing back in the other side of things. The yin to the yang. Yeah, so this is kind of fun. Casually leads him by the hand into the red dust. He gives a show wherever he may be. The Buddha gives a show, good show, wherever he may be. Able to be master in the dust. One day the authority is in one's own hands. He's talking to us. Everywhere life is sufficient in its way. It's not gotten from others. Oh, no matter if one is not as clever as others. No color of shame on the face. No shame. That's liberating. So, let's see. So, skillful means upaya is paying attention, following through. And then I'm talking in the context now of building a place, seeing the big picture purpose of the work of building the sanctuary, not losing sight of that, not getting lost in the weeds of the details, oppressing one or fighting head to head about the details, modeling it for others when they become discouraged with the process. Practicing the patience cultivated through sitting on the cushion with the self. A lot of sitting on the cushion is just practicing patience, cultivating patience with our achy bodies and our racing minds and our difficult feelings. And that's really what it's about. Patience with our own frailties and those of others. Others' frailties and stuck places. So when we see that, we can say, oh, they go through this too. You know, we all want to be happy. They want to be happy. They're kind of stuck. Look at them, you know. helps us realize we're only human. We're all only human. And that's okay. I recently read an article by Suzuki Roshi where he was talking about, he was likening the practice, continuous practice of Zazen over time as burning the kerosene lamp fully. So there's no smoke left on the glass. That's an old illusion, right? Who uses kerosene lamps anymore? We used to use them at Hokyoji. And someone's job was to clean those, clean the smoke off of those. So his metaphor is burning up your life, you know, completely digesting your life. Katagiri's metaphor was digestion. He would say sometimes, just sit down and chew your cud. I think that was his joke about the Midwest. He came from Japan, he lived in California, and he really admired people here and the work ethic, and he was using a metaphor we could get, cows chewing their cud, as a way of digesting our experience continuously over time, sitting with whatever comes up, which is always different. Everything's changing, different things are coming at us, challenges are coming at us. So if we keep sitting, we keep digesting that. And standing up in the middle of our lives, whatever comes. That was another one of his standard teachings, is standing up there, wherever you are, whatever's coming up. So this is from Moon in a Dewdrop. Long ago, a monk asked an old master, when hundreds, thousands, or myriad of objects come all at once, what should be done? The master replied, don't try to control them. Don't try to control them. Whatever comes is the Buddha Dharma, not objects at all. Do not understand the master's reply as merely a brilliant admonition. But realize that it's the truth. Even if you try to control what comes, it cannot be controlled. So, that's a lesson that some of us need to learn over and over and over again. It's an awakening. Something we need to awaken to continuously. I have a Dharma sister who was given this fascicle to work on during the course of her practice with him as her teacher, and because she had difficulty with being overwhelmed with what life would bring, with the details of her life. And this has been a koan for me too in life. The objects just keep coming. They keep coming. So whether we're sitting zazen or whether we're in the middle of our life, our relationships, when objects keep coming, don't try to control them. So then what do we do? What do we do? Well, sit with it. Patience. Become intimate. Become intimate with whatever it is. Don't try to push it away. Don't try to control it. The other thing I've been contemplating is working within the gap between the teachings and my experience, my vow, my aspirations. So what do I do when I don't feel courageous? And I don't feel like I'm able to give non-fear, not only to someone else, but to myself. When I feel flooded with anxious feelings, and this is something people bring to me, they talk to me about, they feel anxiety. Some of that is because the world is all stirred up. That the world has been stirred up for millennia, right? But still, it's stirred up this time in a particular way that's affecting us, right? So, or it could be just for me, it's just being close to, being in touch with the groundlessness of this situation, of the groundlessness of life. And that's something the practice puts one in touch with, puts me in touch with, is the utter groundlessness of things, the nothing to cling to, nothing to hold on to. So that's part of it for me. It's just sometimes that's intense. Sometimes I really feel that in my body. And so then what do I do? Well, I want to just run somewhere, you know, like just get up and run out, go do something, become busy, distract myself. Yeah, that's pretty common, right? Do you ever experience that? Some of you, I'm sure, do. So, and what, you know, and so what do I do when I become angry at someone that I work with whose words or actions trigger my anger? What do I do when I feel hurt because I was the only one in my group of friends who wasn't invited to the party? This is an actual experience from my life lately. Today's the day where I just put it all out there. Or what about when I become incensed with the actions of someone in this society who I think is just acting out of greed and ill will, hatred, and self-centeredness? What do I do with that? So all these things are things that I've experienced, and I would guess that some of you have. And so what do I do when I want to apply my practice to that gap between how I'd like to see myself as a long-time practitioner of Zen who mentors and guides other people in their practice? So that's a piece of suffering right there, right? Is this should no longer be happening to me. That's putting a head on top of your head, as they say in Zen. Is you're already experiencing some intensity of feeling, then you add on something to that, right? So what I do in that case, and what I have done and am doing, is to first of all invoke the kindness of my teachers, Katagiri Roshi, Tim, Tenshin Anderson, other teachers that are my friends and mentors. I invoke that, call that to mind, and then I turn to Pema. I turn to Pema. Her teachings, Pema Chodron, are so great for working in the gap between what we know and what we aspire to do and be, and what the sutras say and the teachings say, and what we're capable of, what we're experiencing, what we're feeling. So, Pema's teaching on moving closer to the feeling. I work with that. I work with that even when I want to get up and do something or run somewhere. I sit with the feeling. I allow it in. I bring it closer. I really allow myself to feel it. Pema says that when we really get close, allow ourselves to be close to the feelings, that they transform into awakening. They transform. They will do that. And we can do that in Zazen too. Just be close to whatever's coming up. Just be close. Just let it in. Just feel it. You know. Impermanence is on our side. And the teacher is Tara Burak. Her teachings on working with anxiety and strong feelings. You know that when we sit with it, she again says, just sit with it and metabolize it. Metabolize it, which is another way of talking about chewing your cud and burning the fuel. And that feeling that you get of vulnerability, when you hang out in that raw place, that vulnerable place, you allow yourself to just be there, where you don't feel powerful, you don't feel strong, you feel vulnerable, you feel raw, you know. That if we can feel that, then we can be close. I feel closer to my partner when I practice that. Just allowing myself to be with that raw place. Another contribution of Pema for me is seeing whatever arises as wisdom energy. In the Tibetan teachings, there are five Buddha families, and anger is one of the Buddha families. And anger, when it's transformed, becomes wisdom. It's clarity. When we say no to something that is, you know, not okay with us, we're like Manjusri, you know, taking his sword out and saying, you know, no, you know. And my teacher, Katagiri Roshi, really helped me when I was first starting to practice and I would come to him with my anger. He just was really helpful in a number of ways, mainly with encouragement, mainly with not being, you know, with being just really accepting of wherever I was at, helping me to use spaciousness as an antidote. You know, if I came to complain to him about someone I was working with, he would say, oh, just look at the clouds. Look at the sky. You know, and I thought at the time that was flaky. But I realize now it's helped me all through my life in practice. And I go back to that. Oh, yeah. And I love the sky. And I really look at clouds all the time. I spend a lot of time. I feel released when I can see the sky. So the name that Katagiri Roshi gave me is Wisdom Mirror. So even that name helps me, you know, with my... I think he... Who knows why he gave me that name, but... transforming anger into wisdom. Mirroring that for others, hopefully. And then befriending it. So move close to what it is. Ask it what it needs. Ask that anxiety. Ask that fear that washes over us. Ask that anger. What do you need? Befriend it. So when I can do that, then I can cultivate the antidote of joy also. The other teacher I really like is Christina Feldman. She was one of the... She was with Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein. And they were over in India and in Asia for years, learning from all these core teachers in those traditions. And my husband and I listened to her talks. She is a... She is a teacher of teachers. She meets with a lot of teachers. And one of the things she said recently when I was watching a presentation of hers to mindfulness teachers was that teachers should really be scared. You should really take it seriously, what your responsibility is and what you know, to embody the Dharma, to close the gap between the teaching and your behavior. I'm winding down. You've been very patient. Thank you. Appreciate the privilege of being able to share with you. So I'd like to wind down with this little poem. I did bring a poem. It's by Jenna Schwartz, and she's a woman. She's a writer who informally mentors me in writing practice and is a poet. And here's what she has to say that I think fits in with all of this. This is a quote first from Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav. The whole world is a very narrow bridge. The important thing is not to be afraid. And here's the poem, Narrow Bridge. If your bridge is rickety, swaying in the wide open chasm between landings, remember this. Don't look down or be afraid. Keep your gaze forward, your breath steady. Tune into the sounds of water rushing, of a faraway bird calling its mate home. Fill your lungs with air. Count on the exhale in all the ways. You've got this. Single file we cross alone but together. The sun rising higher as the fog burns. I love you today. Always have, really. Your courage keeps me from slipping. I really like that poem. Your courage keeps me from slipping. So that's about all I have to say today. And appreciate your listening. And if you would like to make a comment, ask a question, share something you do when you're anxious or angry. Hi.
Did you read the poem?
Oh, that. Okay. I will. I'm used to that. If your bridge is rickety, swaying in the wide open chasm between landings, remember this. Don't look down or be afraid. Keep your gaze forward, your breath steady. Tune into the sounds of water rushing, of a faraway bird calling its mate home. Fill your lungs with air. Count on the exhale in all the ways. You've got this. Single file we cross alone but together. The sun rising higher as the fog burns. I love you today. Always have. Really. Your courage keeps me from slipping. Anything else? We have a few minutes if you want to say anything. Or
I forget where I read it, but the word patient comes from the Latin word pati, or p-a-t-i, which means to suffer.
Yeah, it does kind of make sense, doesn't it? Thanks, Mary Beth. Hey, Mark.
This talk reminded me of a time I was at Moose Lake Correctional Facility, sitting with a group of male offenders there. And after they said they often just have a discussion about what's going on in their lives and bringing our practice to it. One of the guys was complaining about something and some frustration he was facing. He said, "Oh, you gotta be twice happy." And I asked, wasn't quite happy. And the whole room, there was about 8 guys all started laughing. And he said all simultaneously, it means happy when it comes and happy
when it goes. It's pretty good. I like that. Yeah. Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
Sanctuary is such a resonant word these days.
Yeah.
Especially with the government embarking on a program to deport millions of undocumented people. Cities have declared themselves sanctuary cities. It's not clear what that means exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Churches have also declared themselves to be that. And it means offering shelter to individuals and families without documents.
Mm-hmm.
And engaging in some sort of activity in order to make that sanctuary more real.
Mm-hmm.
This could be a question of just sitting in the entryway of the church when the federal officials come to apprehend the person without documents. It could be spreading one's hair. Is that what the Buddha did?
Laying his hair
down. In front
down.
Of the patrol wagon that was going to carry away the people who had been rounded up, not to prepare for its progress, but to impede it.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts?
I think that's important. I think that's a great activity. I think that when communities feel like they can do that, it's wonderful. I teach a mindfulness class at the Unitarian Universalist, and they've become a sanctuary congregation. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's needed. And I'm glad there's communities and cities that feel like they can take the risk, take the chance, and are willing to do it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Anybody else before announcements? Or are we done? Looks like we're done. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.